On this week's 51%, we learn how one state is working to get more women political candidates.
Women don't tend to be self-starters as far as political candidacy goes.
We meet a mother who gave birth during treatment for heroin addiction, and we find out why a California woman rescues horses. I'm Allison Dunn, and this is 51%. And since your history of silence won't do you any good, did you think it would?
Let your words be anything but empty. Why don't you tell them the truth?
Hillary Clinton, as the first woman presidential candidate from a major political party, has turned up the volume on the discussion of women political candidates in general, which brings us to Utah. There aren't many women serving in Utah's legislature, but a new law this election year gives hopeful political candidates a new way to get on their party's primary ballot. Reporter Jennifer Pemberton looked into whether the new alternative to Utah's caucus convention system might help more women get elected.
There are currently 10 women serving in the Utah House of Representatives and 6 in the state Senate. Together, they make up 15% of the 104 elected state legislators. This puts Utah in the bottom 10 states for percentage of women represented in state legislature. There are a lot of reasons for the disparity between men and women serving as elected state officials, but according to Katie Ziegler with the National Convention of State Legislatures, none of them has to do with electability.
There's not bias at the ballot box, and you just have to take a step back and realize that when you look at the numbers, women aren't running for state legislative offices in the numbers that would increase the numbers of women elected. To put it more simply, women aren't running, and so they're not getting elected. When women run, women win.
Except when they don't, which we'll get to in a moment. Maybe it's not obvious why we need more women in office, but we live in a representative democracy, and that means, in theory, that our legislative bodies should look like our population. In Utah, our population is 49.7% female, but our legislature is only 15% female, which isn't very representative. Ziegler says that women running for state legislatures can lead to more women in office all the way up the chain.
Looking nationally and at higher office, such as Congress, currently, about 50% almost of members of Congress previously served in state legislatures. And so you think about political candidates as existing in a pipeline, and there's this pool of people that maybe someday will make a run for Congress, whether it's the House or the U.S. Senate, and there aren't a lot of women in that pool.
One way to add women to that pool is by actively recruiting women to run.
Women don't tend to be self-starters as far as political candidacy goes. It takes recruiting a woman. It takes somebody asking her, you should do it. You should throw your hat in the ring. Women that I work with have told me over and over, someone asked me 4 times before I said yes.
In Utah, that push for more women to run in the first place comes from a group called Real Women Run. The nonpartisan organization holds trainings for potential female candidates on how to manage a campaign, how to fundraise, how to work with the media, even hands-on stuff like how to actually file for candidacy. Pleasant Grove resident Zanny Haney showed up to one of these trainings back in January. By the end of the all-day workshop, she decided she was going to run as a Republican for a seat in the Utah House of Representatives.
We have one demographic, basically, that's making all of our state laws. We need more women on the Capitol Hill. We only have 13% currently in the House of Representatives, and I think we need to encourage more women to run.
The incumbent in Haney's district is Republican Representative Brian Green. And in January, no one was signed up to run against him.
I knew that no one else was going to step up to the game, and I had done my research and was starting to be backed by a lot of local people, and people just kind of rallied behind me and they wanted another option. So for me, that was the decision, and someone needed to step up.
I caught up with Haney at the Utah County GOP convention in April, where the delegates had just voted in her race.
The voting went okay. I landed at 33% approval.
She needed 40% to move on to a primary. And last election, she wouldn't have had enough to stay in the race. But a new state law passed in 2014 gives candidates 2 routes to getting elected. The old caucus and convention route and a new signature gathering route that can get candidates directly onto their party's primary ballot. You can even do both. So if you're a first-time candidate like Haney running against an incumbent like Representative Green, you can try your best to get delegates to vote for you at the convention, and you can gather voter signatures as a backup.
So I started gathering signatures in about February, and I knocked about 800 doors, and that was an interesting experience in the middle of February, but it was a good experience.
How many signatures did you need?
I needed 1,000, and I had to get about 1,800 because only 40% were verifiable.
So Haney forced a primary, so to speak, and prepared to face her opponent. And then her own party started actively campaigning against her. The Utah GOP was opposed to the new law allowing signature gathering from the beginning, and even going so far as to sue the state to overturn it. The Utah County GOP financially supported and endorsed Representative Green as the traditional nominee from the convention and refused to recognize candidates like Haney, who gathered signatures to get on the ballot. In June, she lost the primary by fewer than 200 votes. There's no Democratic candidate for the district, so Representative Brian Green will hold the seat for another term. It's too early to tell how much of an impact the signature gathering option will have on Utah elections, especially when it comes to the representation of women. Utah is only one of seven states that uses the caucus convention primary system, and with this new alternative path to getting elected and all the resistance toward it from the Utah Republican Party, the 2016 election is a real experiment in what representative democracy looks like. For Women Run the West, I'm Jennifer Pemberton.
This story is part of the series Women Run the West, a public radio collaboration exploring the role of women in Western politics. You can hear more stories at womenrunthewest.org. It's hard to take care of a new baby, especially if you're trying to get sober from heroin addiction. We're about to meet a mom, Marissa, who had one daughter when she was using and another while she was in treatment. Marissa asked that we not use her last name. The Innovation Trail's Monica Sandreski met Marissa at the rehab in Delaware County, New York, where she recovered and gave birth to her second daughter, Scarlett.
Marissa pushes a stroller through the halls of New Hope Manor. In the stroller sits Scarlett, an energetic toddler with curly blonde hair.
Can you say hi?
Hi.
Scarlett smiles, big and toothy. Back when she and Marissa called this place home, they went to mom's groups, developed their mom and baby bond, and Marissa learned how to be a responsible parent.
Peek-a-boo, peek-a-boo.
Scarlett was born here, but Marissa's first daughter, Harper, was born while she was still on heroin. Marissa spent her whole life looking for affirmation. She wanted to close what she calls the void. As a teenager, it manifested itself in self-mutilation and an eating disorder. Then, painkillers provided some sense of comfort.
I used to tell people that it was like a nice, warm, fuzzy hug. It was like a whisper that everything's going to be okay.
When painkillers were scarce, she turned to heroin. In each injection was a shot to numb her body and to push her sense of guilt past the point of debilitating. She could barely face herself.
I hated how I looked. I saw the sadness in my eyes, the hardness on my face. I remember looking so distant. I couldn't look in the mirror for a very long time.
Marissa found a ray of hope when she learned she was going to have a baby.
When I got pregnant with my first daughter, I thought, she's going to save me. She's going to be the reason my life changes.
Instead, she changed the opiate, switching to Suboxone. She thought she could control her addiction with a milder drug. It didn't work. She relapsed and spiraled. And while Marissa and baby Harper were living in a hotel room, Child Protective Services took her to court.
When they said that she was being removed from me, I just wanted to die. I went immediately left and tried to get high. Although I wasn't trying to get high anymore, I was trying to die.
She kept doing it. In between suicidal doses of heroin, she missed Harper's first steps. For a year, Marissa played with Harper just 1 hour a week during supervised visits. In that year, she was ashamed to learn she was pregnant again. A doctor mandated she enter a year-long stay here at New Hope Manor, uprooting her from her old environment to finally deal with
the stresses, the triggers, the availability of drugs. Absolutely everything has to change.
And it did. Instead of stresses, she got structure and support. Instead of heroin, She learned coping skills and developed her own personal spirituality. When her second baby was born, Marissa says the state tried to remove her too, but this time New Hope Manor defended her. Baby Scarlett came home with Marissa to the rehab, and the two nurtured a close bond. After Marissa was discharged and moved into an apartment, Harper came to live with her and the baby. Marissa felt guilty she had hurt Harper and confused her, but says she was very forgiving.
She's so happy to have me and her father in her life. It's just overwhelming, and I'm so grateful.
She and Harper have developed a bond, too. She's struck at how similar they are.
Dance. We love to dance. We have so many tutus.
Marissa does worry Harper and Scarlett might have a propensity for addiction, but she watches for it. As Marissa leans back on the couch, her daughter falls asleep on her stomach and quietly coos.
I love this feeling when they fall asleep on you, because there was a time where I did not feel comfortable with me. And the fact that now my two children can feel so safe and secure in my arms, that is the most incredible feeling.
In Delaware County, I'm Monica Sandreski for the Innovation Trail.
Reporting by the Innovation Trail is supported by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. For more, visit innovationtrail.org. We bring you another installment of the 51% segment called Force of Nature from Dr. Sharon Ufberg. She is co-founder of the personal development wellness company Borrowed Wisdom in Napa Valley, California, and she blogs for the Huffington Post. This week, she interviews Ann Houghton, who's been riding horses since she was 4 years old. Houghton began rescuing horses from local auctions more than a decade ago and founded the Oriole Ranch Horse Rescue, which is based in Napa Valley with four locations. That means Houghton, in addition to her full-time job, has to go around to the different locations to check on and feed the horses, among other things. Ufberg asks Houghton how she became involved in horse rescue.
Well, growing up with horses always made life fun and more interesting. I really never knew a world without horses until I went to boarding school in New Hampshire for high school. And I actually had to give up my thoroughbred mare, which broke my heart. But it was until we moved to Napa, California from Connecticut, my mother relocated, and I began looking for a summer job. At about 17 or 18 years old, I ended up finding a job with a horseback riding company, leading tourists through a few different Sonoma-based state parks. And it was a perfect job for me, but it was also an eye-opener. The owner at the time would buy, sell, and trade horses for his dude string. And it was kind of something I wasn't familiar with. He actually was the one who introduced me to the local livestock auction, where along with calves, cows, lambs, sheep, and goats, a handful of horses would also go through. And the horses are sold by the pound. They just went to the highest bidders. A pretty sad place to be. And even though I wasn't really aware of horse slaughter at the time, or actually the terrible sport of horse tripping, it still made me uneasy knowing that people's beloved horses were just selling to anyone without really the interest of knowing where that horse might end up. A few years after I stopped the trail riding, I purchased an unbroke Mustang Cross who I ended up training to ride. He was pretty much unhandleable when I first got him. And it was really a great and proud time for me. We'd come very far together. And I found myself thinking about others like him who perhaps had fallen through the cracks or been overlooked due to not being perfect, maybe untrained or thin or old, and feeling almost an urgency to go to the livestock auction. One day I headed off and found myself looking at a bunch of horses in cramped, dirty pens. A couple of the horses that I saw were older. There was an older Appaloosa gelding who I felt I knew, and it turned out I did know him. He was actually part of the dude string riding outfit that I had worked for a few years previously.
And he was on his way to slaughter?
Well, at that time, it's up in the air still. When horses go into auction, anybody can bid on them. We like to think that there's the possibility that they're going to go to a private home. But for many, especially the older ones, people don't want the extra care and expense that sometimes an older horse requires due to dental care and that kind of thing. But really, it's fate where that horse ends up.
So did you end up adopting that one?
I purchased him. I bid on him and won him for 5 cents a pound. Horses are often sold by the pound. That is very inexpensive. Nobody else wanted him. He was very thin and definitely needed some care, but we got him home and got some much-needed dental work. The horses can get very sharp edges on their teeth, making it very difficult to grind their hay and food properly and therefore losing weight. And so once we did that for him, he blossomed into the big, fat, beautiful horse that he could and should have been. So that was a really great transformation, and it's rewarding. It's rewarding to know that we can do that. And
so you've adopted some other horses since that first one then?
I wouldn't say it's adoption, but we do intervene when possible at auctions. I have also worked directly with kill buyers who have already purchased said horse at auction, and some kill buyers are flexible. And I refer to kill buyers, basically these are usually men, there are some women, but mostly men that go to these auctions to stockpile horses, even ponies and donkeys, they buy them all.
And what do they do and with them?
They bring them to, depends, they will often bring them to a feedlot where they may have as many as 200 horses at a time, so something like a cattle feedlot, if you've ever driven by one. And there are some kill buyers that ship direct, meaning they buy horses from an auction, and that night they load them up in their trailer and drive either to Mexico or Canada. There are currently no operating slaughterhouses for horses for human consumption in the U.S., something that many of us have worked hard on over the last couple of years.
So how many horses have the Oriel Ranch Rescue, how many horses have you rescued? How many do you currently have?
We currently have 17 in our care. We have definitely saved more than that. We've been able to adopt some of our horses out. People ask, well, how do you adopt? We have a contract very similar to any other adoption agency. There are certain stipulations that need to be met, and we'll do a follow-up and make sure that everything is going well. And if for some reason they need to rehome that horse, which does happen, that we are notified and get first opportunity to take that horse back.
So is your primary goal for the horses that you rescue to get them adopted?
Well, yes, and sometimes it's a little bit random. We had a really cute little mare that we rescued from slaughter up in Washington State. I try to post photos of all the horses on especially our Facebook page. I'd say that's our main venue for the public. And we had a girl down in Monterey area contact us, and we ended up bringing Mare down there and doing a trial period of 30 days, and it was a good match. And so, yes, that's the biggest thing, is adopting the horses out to a good home is really our number one focus, because until we can get that horse or horses into new homes, we have limited space and definitely limited financial abilities to take on more horses. So although we're in this for a reason, most rescuers are just big bleeding hearts, and under the right circumstances, even if we're full, we will often take a dire needs case on occasion. So
the ranch must have a lot of needs, you know, space needs, financial needs. What are you looking at right now for 2016 and 17? What are your big items that you do need?
Financial needs are always the biggest. Between our hay bills, vet bills, farrier, and having to rent space to keep our horses, we pay a little, well, over $30,000 a year to maintain the horses. So definitely not inexpensive.
Ann Houghton, it's been wonderful to hear about your amazing work. Thank you so much from all of us horse lovers. And this is Dr. Sharon Ufberg on Force of Nature for 51%.
The Veterans Administration is still working to shorten wait times for patients to get medical care, but one of its latest proposals, for which the comment period has closed, has some doctors upset. It would allow specially trained nurses to treat patients in some specialties without a doctor's oversight. Patricia Murphy reports.
The proposed rule concerns what are known as advanced practice registered nurses. That includes nurse practitioners, clinical nurse specialists, and certified registered nurse anesthetists, people who've had advanced training in a particular specialty. Right now, in many VA medical centers, they can only see patients if they're supervised by a doctor. But under the proposal, they could work independently. The VA's Penny K. Jensen, who's a nurse practitioner, says that would standardize the VA system. It would help reduce staffing shortages and get veterans seen more quickly.
If nurse practitioners were able to function to the level of their education, training, and certification, we would be able to see patients in a more timely manner. We would be able to decrease those wait times in primary care.
The rule would allow all of the VA's nearly 6,000 advanced practice registered nurses, depending on their credentials, to do routine checkups, manage chronic conditions like diabetes, and provide anesthesia. Jensen says within the VA, those types of nurses now operate under the laws of whatever state they're licensed in, which is inconsistent across the country, and even can lead to inconsistent care in the same hospital.
So we may have a nurse practitioner practicing in Colorado, and they may be practicing on a Georgia license, but they would have to follow the regulations of that Georgia license.
Jensen says the policy would bring the VA in line with the Department of Defense, the Indian Health Service, and civilian hospitals in some states. But physicians groups say the change would give some nurses too much authority over patient care. American Society of Anesthesiologists President-elect Dr. Jeffrey Plagenhoff says the VA hasn't done conclusive research on how complex surgeries might be impacted.
Anesthesiology is inherently dangerous, and it becomes even more dangerous as sickness increases. So veterans are more likely to have had heart attacks, strokes, emphysema, congestive heart failure, and conditions such as those, which dramatically increase the likelihood of problems before, during, and after surgeries.
But nurses reject the assertion that VA patients are too complex for nurse anesthetists to manage safely. Juan Quintana is president of the American Association of Nurse Anesthetists. He says they've already proven they can work independently in the operating room.
I personally work in a rural facility in Northeast Texas, and that is the model of practice that we utilize today. And it is very effective, very safe. Our outcomes are amazing. We take care of patients in all ages, all types of surgeries, for all kinds of procedures, without any difficulty whatsoever.
Since the proposal was announced, more than 200,000 comments, including 50,000 paper comments, have poured into the federal government, far more than is typical for a proposed policy change. The VA hasn't finished tabulating them yet. Once they do, the VA Undersecretary for Health will decide whether there's a policy change, but it likely will be a while before that happens. I'm Patricia Murphy reporting.
And that's our show for this week. Thanks to Patrick Garrett for production assistance. Our executive producer is Dr. Alan Shartok. Our theme music is Glow in the Dark by Kevin Bartlett. This show is a national production of Northeast Public Radio. If you'd like to hear this show again, sign up for our podcast or visit the 51% archives on our website at wamc.org. This week's show is number 1420.